몰라서.
So I mentioned yesterday something that's kind of always on my mind, and that is the importance of kind of revitalizing or shining a fresh light on the role of contemplative inquiry, that it really is inquiry. We're not simply learning the creed, we're not simply getting the right answers, adopting the correct belief system, or performing rituals and devotions and faith and so forth. All of those have their place. But actual contemplative inquiry with the idea that you can actually make discoveries, not just come up with subjective impressions, but actually make discoveries as much as mathematicians make discoveries, physicists, neuroscientists, and so on. And moreover, that these discoveries can be corroborated, that there can be peer review. In fact, there has been peer review, and that there can be a very large body of intersubjectively corroborated consensual knowledge, which is what we have in mathematics. That is, they have it, I don't have it, because I'm not a good enough mathematician. But there's an enormous body of knowledge in mathematics that any knowledgeable mathematician knows. We know this stuff. And here's the cutting edge, and here's where there's debate, and here's where there's uncertainty. But this, and it's a massive amount. You know, mathematics has been going on a long time. And of course, for physics, so much consensual knowledge. And then out on the cutting edge, then is string theory, is that valid, or is it quantum cosmology, or was it, you know, there are other theories out there as well. But so much consensual knowledge, you know. And there is in Buddhism too. And there, as I am persuaded, there's actually an enormous body of consensual knowledge, even among diverse traditions, the Taoist, the Theravada Buddhist, the Zen, the Christian, and so forth. But one needs to know how to identify it. But even if you find common ground, you find commonality, that doesn't necessarily mean they actually know what they're talking about. It's just that they've drawn similar conclusions, you know. So then kind of like, so what? If they all just drew conclusions, but they're all just speculating in the same way, then it's not interesting. Whereas in mathematics, you know they're not just speculating in the same way. Enormous mind power went into that, you know, brilliant minds. And they can demonstrate to each other, you know, the really brilliant ones, they can demonstrate to each other that they have found this knowledge. This, you know, I'm sure it's brilliant, this 150-page proof of Fermat's last theorem. That must be breathtaking. I couldn't even read the first line. But I find that awesome, you know. And it's so subjective, because there's no way you can just kind of, you know, show a photo or show a graph or show some empirical evidence that anybody who not had very, very advanced training in mathematics could make any clue of it. No way. And yet there it is, consensual knowledge, and it's intersubjective knowledge among those who have sufficient training. So when I look at philosophy, I mean, there's been so much philosophy in the West, and a lot of it's brilliant. I mean, really profound ideas. I often say, oh, you know, they don't agree. Well, they don't. That doesn't mean there are not just, that the stream of Western philosophy is not filled with golden nuggets all over the place. It is. Tremendous insights. And just to cite one, Hilary Putnam, he passed away just a couple of months ago. But what he did by putting together insights from Kant, Wittgenstein, and William James, I find it just breathtaking. Now he's passed away, and his volumes of his life's work are there in the vast libraries of, you know, of the universities and so on. The theories from quantum cosmology I find absolutely breathtaking, from John Wheeler, Stephen Hawking, and so forth, Anton Zeilinger, and so forth. But of course they're not accepted by everybody. And Hilary Putnam, well, as I said, philosophers don't agree. So he was widely regarded as a very fine, distinguished philosopher. But then many of those who regard him as distinguished disagree with him. They don't have that consensual knowledge. They didn't come up with a vast body of intersubjectively validated consensual knowledge. And then likewise, in my book, Mind and the Balance, I went into some detail about Shama Devapashin and Dzogchen, and then finding, I think, significant parallels between Dzogchen and the Kabbalah, quantum cosmology, the Neoplatonic tradition of Christianity, Advaita Vedanta, said, look, it looks like they're really pointing in the same direction here. But then my book is just one more book, you know, hidden in the library. So there's one common denominator, and that is, even at the time of Galileo, Copernicus had already come out decades before with his theory that the sun is in the center and the planets go around it. But there was no intersubjective consensual knowledge. There were a lot of theologians, Christians, astronomers, and so forth, who agreed with him, and others disagreed with him. And that was it. That was it. They just disagreed and agreed. It wasn't outlawed by the church. There were theologians that agreed with it. But it was just like, well, he said, she said. But in fact, back then, it was all he said, because the women were in the kitchen, you know, cooking. Women had no voice, unfortunately. And then Galileo. And then Galileo. The telescope. Made observations. And within a matter of years, he proved that the geocentric view was wrong. And any knowledgeable person that saw what he had discovered, and maybe made it themselves, is not that difficult. That's primitive astronomy. If they can see the implications, then from that point on, I mean, knowledgeable people, shortly after Galileo, they saw well. The Ptolemaic version of the Earth in the center and all these epicycles and eccentrics and the sun and everything going around it's false. It's not an opinion now. If you have that opinion, you're ignorant because you're wrong and this is right. Because Galileo showed the empirical evidence for that. You know? And it was the phases of Venus that really nailed it. Right? And we have so much like that. But it was the telescope. Galileo just had one more opinion like everybody else. He already believed that Copernicus was right before he found the proof. Kepler already believed that Copernicus was right before Galileo came up with the proof. Right? The telescope. Shamatha. What philosophers lack, including the most brilliant ones, and Hilary Putnam takes my breath away, Wittgenstein, many profound insights, and the list goes on. There are many, many brilliant, so amazing their insights. And yet, they didn't find that method to intersubjectively validate or invalidate each other's theories. So you just have this great big mine of all kinds of ideas for 2,000 years, or 3,000 years. Of ideas, but they didn't have the method to put Hilary Putnam's theories to the test of experience and see whether he's correct, or, of course, they're very brilliant materialists. They're not unintelligent. So are they correct? Well, they can't prove their theories either. They can't. They never have. They just have, it's like a very large church where everybody in the church, they all believe because they're in that denomination. And then they just like to ignore everybody outside the denomination and assume they're ignorant or stupid. Like John Searle said, you know, if you're not aware that the mind is simply a function of the brain, then you're ignorant or stupid. Well, he's a good church member. Apparently, he just doesn't get out of his church, and he only talks with people in his church. His church is called UC Berkeley, by the way, where there are in fact a lot of widely divergent views. It's a marvelous university, but it would seem by his statement that he just doesn't talk to people. He doesn't talk to people. I mean, he and I debated. I don't think he heard a word I said, except for to try to refute it, unsuccessfully. You know. So, shamatha. It's the telescope. Brilliant theories in Buddhism. Mahamudra, Dzogchen, Guhyasamaja, Kalachakra, these are brilliant theories. You know, they're really, truly breathtaking. But are we really demonstrating the validity if we don't have the technology, if we're not utilizing the technology of shamatha and the rigorous, very demanding, sometimes exhausting modes of investigation of vipassana? If it's not backed by the shamatha vipassana and we're simply doing state regeneration, completion, and then talking, debating, clapping our hands about vipassana, we're in the same soup. We're in the same soup. We're not demonstrating. So the Nyingmapas believe in Dzogchen. Most Gelugpas think, not so great. They don't like it that much. And you know, Prasangika versus Yogacara and so forth. So this retreat, the way I'm teaching, obviously, is not for everybody. Most people who read science don't want to become scientists. They like being observers, you know, reading what the scientists come up with. We don't There's not enough space for that many scientists. This course here is really for people who would like to become contemplatives. The intention was, my aspiration, my motivation, what keeps me still teaching. I teach in different ways, not only one. But this type of retreat, really the intended people are for those who are really seeking the path. Really seeking the path, really seeking to know. And knowing's not going to be easy. This is not designed to be popular or to be fun. Hopefully it is fun on occasion, but there's no way it's going to be fun every day. Because nyam come up, life happens. So I do believe that if shamatha could be introduced into theoretical physics, they might, shamatha and then vipassana, they might actually be able to put to test these theories by Thomas Hertog that I cited before, and John Wheeler, Stephen Hawking, and so forth. They could put those to the test. They really could, actually. Hilary Putnam's incredibly brilliant internal realism or pragmatic realism, which just looks awfully close to Madhyamaka, that could be put to the test. You could actually know, you know. And the teachings on Dzogchen, I mean, they sound marvelous, clearly. But you can actually put to the test if they're supported with the muscle of shamatha vipassana, which Padmasambhava himself makes so abundantly clear, and Pinchinabuchi himself makes so abundantly clear that without shamatha, you don't have any of the paths, right? It's indispensable for Shravakayana, Parajyekabuddhayana, Bodhisattvayana, and for that matter, Vajrayana. Indispensable. So if this fades out, then Buddhism will continue on as an array of philosophies, which will be debated extensively in the monastic universities and in academia, Yogacara, Prasangika, Madhyamaka, and so forth, and Mahamudra and Dzogchen views and so forth. It'll be debated, it'll be discussed and taught. So philosophically, it's robust, it'll be continuing as a philosophical tradition. And as a religious tradition, I think the prospects are good. There are a lot of people who are being deeply nourished by the religious elements of Buddhism, Tibetan Buddhism, for example, with the rituals, the worship, the devotions, the visualizations, the Vajrasattva practice, Jeju generation, and so forth. That will continue. That will continue. And it's a good thing. I have only reference for all of these aspects, for the philosophical and the religious. But as long as Dalai Lama keeps on emphasizing, but in Buddhism there's a science of mind, there's a science of mind. And he's not alone, but I am his disciple in this one, absolutely. It's a science of mind, which means there are scientific assertions within Buddhism that can be tested, have been tested, and can be intersubjectively validated by people with sufficient training. But without shamatha, it ain't going to happen. So, we return to shamatha here, and now this is kind of we're coming to the end of the first 5 weeks. We'll have 3 weeks left. This is the end. This is the end. The end of the line of shamatha, right? We're almost at the end of the line. Now we're getting out of the train. We came to the end of the line yesterday morning when I was reading the concluding passage by Padmasambhava in Natural Liberation of shamatha without a sign, after directing the awareness up, to the right, to the left, down, to the heart, and then releasing it to space. Then he says, okay, now just continue until you've settled your mind in its natural state, and don't be introduced to Rigpa too soon, right? For that matter, don't be introduced to Madhyamaka too soon, because it just turned into a head trip. I know it. I've done it. That's what happens. If you're a smart cookie, I'm a smart cookie, by the way. I'm a smart cookie. You know, there are many, many smarter cookies, but, you know, compared to orangutans and chimpanzees and so forth, I'm a smart cookie. So I know how that. It goes to your head. You get really clever. You know how to debate and beat people in debate. Show what a sharp cookie you are. Gyatranabhaja called me smart aleck. He wasn't kidding. It just goes to your head. But you want it to go to your heart. And for your heart has to have peace. It's that simple, actually. If there's peace in your heart, if there's serenity, if there's calm, if your own heart, you know, is your wellspring of your own well-being, it brings you a sense of ease, a sense of peace, a sense of inward well-being, that actually brings up, at least on occasion, a sense of joy, and you know where it's coming from, then you don't need to prove yourself to anybody else. You don't need other people's approval. You don't need their respect. You don't really need much at all except for food, clothing, shelter. That's actually quite enough. Because you need the hedonic. You don't want to starve to death. You want to be too cold and so forth. But beyond that, you don't really look to the world. You don't look outwards for your happiness. You don't need to. And therefore, you don't need other people's respect, their approval, their admiration and so forth. If it happens, it happens. It's good. It's like a day like this. Well, I couldn't order this, but I certainly enjoy it, you know. But it will be cloudy again, and that'll be fine. So Padmasambhava left us on that note of now release the mind into space, concluding just before he enters into engaging in the search for the mind, enters into full-fledged vipassana. But now in another of the works, now that was an earth dharma, discovered in, 14th century, I think, by Kamalingba, natural liberation, tracing back to Padmasambhava. And now we have much more recently, mid to late 19th century, these revealed teachings in Pure Visions by Dzogchen Lingpa, again coming from Padmasambhava, the lake-born Vajra. And one of the least known of these five treatises that are either written by or transmitted by Dzogchen Lingpa is this text, the Enlightened View of Samatabhadra. It's just breathtaking. Because it takes the depth of the Vajra essence, which is very long and very detailed and quite awesome, but it's very large, you know. And then it just condenses it down from 400 pages down to 80. And it's still a complete path, you know. And so right towards the beginning of that, we read right towards the beginning, I did yesterday, and that is examining which is primary body, speech, and mind, recognize the mind as the all-creating sovereign of samsara and nirvana, and then, having set up your target, like a good chittamatran, mind is primary. It all boils down to the mind. The mind is creator of everything. Having set up your target, sounds so familiar, doesn't it? The object of negation. Having set up the target, so like everything else is hushed, the whole physical world has kind of faded out. Right? Because the whole so-called physical world has just been reduced to appearances, empty, non-physical appearances of the mind. So it's kind of like a hush falls over the crowd. And all that's left is mind. The source of samsara and nirvana. And having set up the target, then he goes for it. Right into it. Right into the nucleus. And asking, okay, mind, are you material? Do you have physical properties? Nye. The answer was in Russian. I don't know why it was in Russian, but it was definitely nye. And then, do you really come from someplace? Are you really present someplace? Do you really go? Nye, nye, nye. Okay, we're finished. The Russians have spoken. And then he goes into the next phase, the placement exam. Okay, you have a perspective now. But of course, you're probably not enlightened yet. Probably not fully awakened yet. So now, going from here to perfect awakening, to realize this fully. Okay, what's your path? What's your path? And he starts out with a placement exam. Just like if you have a child who's been homeschooled for some time, maybe even some years, but then sooner or later you decide to introduce the child into the school system, right? And so, how well have you homeschooled the child? Is the child ready for fifth grade, for seventh grade, third grade? You want to make sure that the child is well placed so that the class the child is introduced to isn't challenging but not overwhelming. And not so easy that is underwhelming. The child just cruising along, wasting time, right? So he gives a placement exam. And that's what we're going to do right now. Find a comfortable position. with the motivation to set out on the path to perfect awakening for the sake of all sentient beings, while taking refuge in your own pristine awareness, the ultimate refuge. With such a motivation, settle your body, speech, and mind in the natural state, and briefly calm the mind with mindfulness of breathing. Now we turn to the Lake Bon Vajra for further guidance on entering the path and knowing what avenue shall we follow, what approach shall we take. So Lake Bon Vajra gives this counsel. Now it is crucial for you to know your own causal characteristics. There are two kinds of paths. Individuals with supreme faculties within themselves, individuals with supreme faculties proceed within themselves by way of direct crossing over, which is the most advanced phase of Dzogchen practice. They just go directly there. And individuals with middling or inferior faculties proceed gradually in dependence upon the grounds and paths. And that is the Bodhisattva Bhumis and the five paths to enlightenment. So some go right to the top of the class, to the most advanced stage of practice, and they proceed right from there to enlightenment. They already have so much momentum. They don't need to take this very gradual approach, step by step, shamatha, vipassana, texture. They go directly to Turtgel, direct crossing over. So where are we? Where are we placed? There could be people here in Tuscany. There could be people listening by podcast. Or superior, there could be middling, there could be inferior. Where are we? How do we assess this? So he tells us, to investigate this, first of all, merge your mind with empty external space and remain in meditative equipoise for 20 days. By so doing, individuals of the first type, those with superior faculties, will perceive the originally pure essential nature of the primordial ground with the eye of wisdom, and they will identify this within themselves. So it's the entrance exam. If within 20 days you cut right through just with this one practice, you cut right through to realization of Rigpa, and you are seeing or perceiving this originally pure essential nature of the primordial ground, pristine awareness, with the eye of wisdom, of prajna, well, you will identify this within yourself. So we don't have 20 days right now, certainly not this morning, but we can begin. So I'll give a bit of guidance how to merge the mind with what he calls external space. As before, let your eyes be gently open. The preparation is the same as before, evenly resting your awareness within space, while at the same time resting your awareness in its own place, holding its own ground, with no object, without doing anything. Now, Padmasambhava does not suggest this, but just to make this as accessible as possible, this very simple practice, I'm going to teach it in stages. When you don't need the stages, just go to the practice itself. But we'll take it step by step. So as you've done before, maintain just a peripheral awareness, just enough awareness of the sensations of the respiration. Just enough so that you're aware of the rhythm when the breath is flowing in, when it's flowing out, while resting your awareness in its own nature. And as the breath is flowing out, it's a very natural time to release, to let go, to relax deeply. Release your mind. And this means every aspect of your mind, your thoughts, your memories, emotions, desires, images, everything that the mind comes up with. As the breath flows out, release it outwards into external space that has no limits. Release it into space with no remainder. Let it dissolve into space, every aspect of your mind. And at the same time, release your awareness into space. Don't keep it cramped up, cramped inside your head. Don't keep it limited on the leash somewhere in here, inside your head, or over here. Release it too. Release your mind, release awareness. Let it off the leash and release it into space, this objectless open expanse with no target, no object. Merge your awareness with space. Not objectifying space. Releasing your awareness into space, non-dually. With every out-breath. And with each in-breath, do not in any way withdraw, contract, or invert your awareness. Simply accentuate, heighten the awareness of the sheer luminosity of awareness itself, without relinquishing that open release into space. simply heighten the awareness of awareness. With each exhalation, experience the emptiness of this open expanse of space. With each inhalation, accentuate your awareness of the luminosity, the clarity, the brightness of your own awareness. Emptiness and luminosity, breath by breath. And as for the mind, just release it, irreversibly release it into space, let it dissolve into space. And all that remains in the absence of the mind is the non-conceptual, non-duality of emptiness and luminosity. Is that so or not? Examine closely. It's a little bit like pumping up a tire. As you breathe out, release your mind and any recurrence of the mind, any thought, image, memory that comes to mind, release it, let it dissolve into that space. And then with each in-breath, fill that space. Pump up that space. Saturate that space with the luminosity of awareness. So it's a crude analogy. But to fill the tire. With the luminosity of your awareness until it's full. Until it can't be any more full. Sufficiently full. Very much like the accumulation of merit. You accrue it until the battery is fully charged. So fill this open expanse of space, breath by breath, with the luminosity, the cognizance of your own awareness, until it's full. Until there's no difference in your experience between the exhalation and the inhalation, the emphasis on emptiness and the emphasis on luminosity, when there's no longer any difference. Your experience of emptiness is saturated by luminosity, and your experience of luminosity is non-dual from emptiness. Then stop pumping. Release the oscillation. And rest in that non-duality without doing anything. Utterly at ease, still, and clear. And let's continue practicing now in silence. So in fact, we do have 20 more days in this retreat. And how you spend, you here in Tuscany, how you spend, what kind of meditations you focus on when you're in your own rooms, you're walking about, of course, it's up to you. I'm here to help you in your practice, not to try to get you to conform to some any kind of expectations I might or might not have. Yeah. So if you wanted to try it, of course you can. He's suggesting, of course, you do it all day. You know, all day for 20 days to really put it to the test. But just on that note, briefly, I'm going to give just a short quote, a concluding quote on this topic from Padmasambhava. But also, as we all know, this afternoon we're going to go back to Panchanamuchi. We'll really then be moving through his presentation of Vipassana. It's quite clear that this man was chosen to be the tutor of the fifth Dalai Lama because he was brilliant, just like the late tutors of his own Dalai Lama of this incarnation, Ling Rinpoche and Kyabji Tijan Rinpoche. They were just brilliant, just brilliant. I was just afraid of Ling Rinpoche. I met him once. He debated with me. And I just basically went on my back. I just kind of threw down my sword. I was in the Buddhist school dialect at the time, so he kind of assumed maybe I knew how to debate. And he just started, and he went, threw down my sword. You're right, I'm wrong. He just intimidated me utterly. And Kyabji Tijan Rinpoche, just as brilliant, but he I could speak to, and not just go into total meltdown. So the Panchen Rinpoche is of that class, you know. Truly brilliant. And it's going to be hard to follow him. Just like it's hard to follow Einstein. It's hard to follow really super brilliant people. It's hard, you know. And so it's going to be demanding in the afternoon. The meditations will be demanding. And if over these next 3 weeks, all that is done is sowing seeds for the future, that's good. That's good. But I would encourage you, please don't be overwhelmed. It's easy to be overwhelmed. I've been overwhelmed many times. I know what it's like. You know, please don't be overwhelmed. Just when you come here for the evenings, engage as well as you can. And then as soon as you're finished, as soon as 6 o'clock, you're on your own. And if you'd like to spend, you know, most of your meditative time just going back to your favorite shamatha practice, go for it. Go for it. And you want to augment that with other practice, state regeneration, guru yoga, preliminary practices, go for it. Okay? So really emphasize the practices you really find helpful. And we'll be sowing the seeds for the long-term, you know, the long-term harvest with the Vipassana. And in that regard, too, sometimes I think we can just feel kind of oppressed by our own minds. I know it's possible. I've been oppressed by my mind many times. And sometimes we may link it to another person. Oh, I feel so rotten because of what this person said, or that person did, or this happened. Therefore, I feel so rotten. I feel miserable. I feel depressed. I feel heavy. My self-esteem is shattered, and so forth. And, you know, because of this and that and the other. There's only one thing that's causing you to have low self-esteem or depression or any other troubles of the mind. It's your own mind. Because how does anybody else really trouble your mind? I mean, if you want to trouble somebody else's body, take out a rock and hit him with it. I'm not suggesting you do that, but the body is vulnerable. If you want to hurt somebody physically, it's not brain science. Just hit them, you know, and they will hurt. So please don't do that. But hurting the body is very straightforward, and you can say, "My arm is bruised because Paola punched me." She's so serene. She just smiles like a Buddha. I just told her that she punched me, just smiling, so serene. I have to pick on somebody else. Okay. No, I like Polly. She you know, she's so tough. She punched me on a big bruise. Then we can say that makes really good sense. Yeah, you got a big bruise on your arm. Okay, Paula just came and whacked me. That makes really good sense. Because you can find my arm, you can find people's bodies. It's very easy to do. Exactly how do you punch somebody's mind? It's like trying to punch space. You know, you can't really do it. The only thing that can punch your mind is your mind. The only thing that can harm your mind is your mind. So if the mind gets obnoxious, if you really identify who's really tormenting your mind, and you see it's not just your mind as a whole, but elements within the mind, and especially on a day like this, for those of us here looking out over these craggy peaks on the horizon in Tuscany and the magnificent sky, You know, if you get tired of your mind, just, you know, give it a rest. Give it, take it off the leash and just let it run. You know, just mind, you're not a very good neighbor. As that old saying I've quoted so many times, my mind's like a bad neighborhood, right? I try not to go there myself, by myself, right? When your mind's like that, where it's just kind of just beating you up, you're unhappy and so forth, depressed, anxious, low self-esteem, whatever it may be, just say, mind, you know, you're not a very good neighbor. I'm sitting on vacation. Go to Tuscany. Out. Come back when you're nicer. And just rest in awareness. I'm actually quite serious. Go for a walk and just release your mind into space. All your cares, concerns, all the thoughts, all the chit-chat, all the mental affliction, just release it. If the mind isn't nice, get rid of it. And just rest in awareness, rest in what's left over. And that is the clear blue sky and the sound of the wind and awareness. Okay? Onaso. So he concludes, and we will conclude, individuals of the latter two types, if you're a middling or person of inferior faculties, will be, if you do that, if you go into solitude for 20 days and you just try to do this all day, what we just did, they will be tormented by confusion and distress, and since their minds do not seem to merge with space, they will pass the time in fabrications and striving while being caught up in many thoughts. Anything ring a bell? Here's the way for them. So in case you're just not a person of superior faculties, you're not ready to go right into graduate work and contemplative studies at, you know, the Santa Barbara Institute. Here is the way for them to enter upon the grounds and paths, people of middling and inferior faculty. They should practice by abiding in consciousness or resting in consciousness and recognizing the movements of thoughts as follows. Like people watching a show of optical illusions. So now we've had three metaphors. Watching optical illusions, watching the shepherd watching the flock, the old man watching other people's children play, right? Very similar mood. Like people watching a show of optical illusions. Watching the show, by meditating diligently with keen enthusiasm, all the subtle and coarse assemblies of thoughts will be calmed, emphasizing this word, calmed, in the ocean of the primordial ground, and they will abide in a state of unwavering stillness, emphasized, and there will arise the experience of shamatha. Calmed stillness, shi-ne. He just gave the etymology of shi-ne, shamatha. Calm, still. Calm presence, calm stillness. At this time, so he's kind of just cutting through, you know, what happens when you achieve shamatha. At this time, there will arise bliss like the warmth of a fire, luminosity like the breaking of dawn, and non-conceptuality like an ocean unmoved by waves. The vivid perception, and now this is highlighted again, the vivid perception of mindfulness that does not bifurcate stillness and movement in that state, is called vipassana. Vivid perception, then, is the etymology of hlak tong. Hlak as in something superior, vivid, extraordinary. Tong is perception or seeing. So there's vipassana. The vivid perception of mindfulness that does not bifurcate stillness and movement. The stillness of your awareness with the movements of appearances does not bifurcate subject and object and reify that bifurcation. That's vipassana. That was simple, wasn't it? Right to the point. When you have identified shamatha as a meditative experience and then naturally sustain it with mindfulness, free of attachment and clinging, the appearances of meditative experiences will naturally vanish. The nyam, all those nyam, will subside. They will vanish. And single-pointed mindfulness will manifest. So he's just given the marching orders for everybody who is of middling or inferior faculty. Enjoy your day. See you later.